Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
Stand by.
Yep, he's done it again, folks.
Oh, no, not again. Oh, my. Oh, my. Oh, my goodness gracious.
Named to Talkers Magazine's Heavy 100 for the third year in a row.
It's not the first time. It won't be the last.
He's Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate.
Welcome back. It's 34 after the hour. Thank you very much for joining me. Thanks for hanging out with me today. It's my pleasure to be able to continue to be with you as we go through the day, as we continue into the week. And you're going to be glad you hung out with us today because our good friend Ken Crozen is with us. Ken is Kenneth is attorney, is an intellectual property attorney. He's a partner at Foley & Lardner, which is an outstanding law firm in Washington, D.C. As I told you earlier in the hour, I knew about Ken before I knew him. I was telling you about him and about his work, his research, before you actually met him and before I introduced him on the show. And his work has been so compelling to me. And to the point where I used his work in many of my speeches and have been doing it for years. His work was so compelling to me, I just had to find him and connect him to our show and bring him in here. And he's been our member of our Brain Trust now for a few years, and he's our good friend. Ken, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jim. Good morning. How are you?
It's good. We're doing great. It's good to have you back, as always. Always a pleasure to have you back. But before we get into a couple of topics, there's some interesting history that I wanted to mention right now. On this day in 1808, Ken, the leather splitting machine was patented by Samuel Parker. Leather splitting machine. 1808. How about that? Now,
well,
where would we be today?
Back in the good old days.
Where would we be today if we weren't able to split leather, right? It gets better though. These are two even better ones. 1878, the corn cob pipe was patented by Henry Tibby. Corn cob pipe. How about that?
That's pretty good.
I mean, think about that. Who ever thought that you'd actually patent the corn cob pipe? But I've got one more, Ken. It's even better than all those, and this is really a red-letter day for me when I think about this invention. 1872, the donut cutter was patented by John Blondell.
Well, I'll tell you, Jim, those three things sort of illustrate a point, which is that a lot of people have an elevated sense of patentability. They don't really understand that you can get patents on lots of relatively minor improvements and minor inventions. And maybe these are not minor inventions, but things that people just don't think are really worthy of patents, you can patent.
Well, a donut cutter is not minor, as far in my opinion, there, Ken. That's a pretty significant. That's a pretty important device, as far as I'm concerned. But your point is well taken, and that's where there has to be, there has to be two elements. It seems to me, Ken, involved in whether you want to go forward with a patent. Number one, you need to find out if you can be. And that's the legal side. And number two, you need to find out whether it should be patented. And that's the business side, isn't it?
That's right, Jim. And I've had people many times over the years come to me and say, gee, I have a great idea. I'd love to get a patent on it. And my first word of advice to them is, first of all, it costs some money to get a patent. But secondly, and most importantly, you really need to think about whether there's any commercial market for the thing that you want to patent. If there's not, my advice is don't do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're not saying, of course, even if there is commercial application, you could still leverage that commercial ability, but just keep that invention as a trade secret.
That's correct.
Yeah. So anyway, I thought you'd get a kick out of those three things. The leather splitting machine, the corncob pipe. And that surprised me when I saw that. That surprised me that somebody actually patented the corncob pipe. I wonder how much money he made off of that. See, that's what I don't know. I wish I knew the financial benefit of these guys. And then, of course, the donut cutter was patented as well. Those are three pretty outstanding ones.
I wonder if somebody got a patent on the bagel cutter after the donut cutter was invented.
They probably knocked it off. Probably some Chinese bagel manufacturer knocked off the donut cutter or something, didn't they? Folks, Ken was just in China, and he just returned for 2.5 weeks. He was in China at an international intellectual property conference. And when he comes back, when we come back after this next break, I want Ken to talk to us about what he learned while he was over there. And I want to overlay some of the things you and I've learned from some of our other China experts and see if there's any consistency there. And we'll do that right after these messages. It's 20 till the hour. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. Ken Crozen is our guest. Stay with us.
Spinning at the mercy of an unrelenting force. So we stare into the emptiness and fall beneath the weight, circling the nexus and a fever dance with fate.
The late, great Dan Fogelberg, ladies and gentlemen. The Nexus, part of the Innocent Age album, still one of my favorites. 17 till, I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. Thank you for hanging out with me. My websites are smallbusinessadvocate.com. That's where you can find the show and the archives of the shows that we've done all the way back to 99. Ken Crozen is our guest this half hour, and you can go back and listen to so many interviews that we've done with him over the years. To an incredible body of work that you can still listen to. And also, all of our archives are podcastable if you want to do that, in addition to streaming them. And, of course, you can find hundreds of thousands, actually, of articles that I've written and my Brain Trust members have written. The blog is there. Our newsletter subscription is there. You can do that. We send that to you every week on Sunday afternoon by email, get you ready for the week ahead. And, of course, don't forget our knowledge base, askjim.biz, where you get small business answers. Now, that's part of my intellectual property, folks. And that's what we're talking about with our good friend Ken Crozen. And, Ken, you just got back from – by the way, Ken, folks, Ken is a partner with Foley & Lardner, a law firm in Washington, D.C. Ken, you just got back from China, intellectual property conference. What did you learn?
Well, I took a delegation to China, Jim, from the American Intellectual Property Law Association, AIPLA, which is the largest bar association devoted to intellectual property in the U.S., over 17,000 members. And our delegation went to Shanghai, Beijing, and Shenzhen, which are really the three largest cities in China. And the purpose of the visit was we were invited over there by the Chinese government, the State Intellectual Property Office, which is comparable to our patent office, and the mm-hmm. Chinese Intellectual Property Society. And the purpose of the visit was for our group to learn as much as we possibly could about what was going on in China, and for us to exchange views with the Chinese officials and attorneys that we met.
Very important conversation.
Very important. And,
Ken, pardon me. Folks, our government has talks with countries like China and Russia about nuclear armament, about ways to keep us from killing each other with our weapons. In my opinion, Ken, I don't want to overdramatize this too much, but in my opinion, the conversations that you're having with your peers in China is tantamount to the kind of conversations the governments are having, because I believe that we are in much greater danger from China stealing our stuff and undermining us that way than we are from them firing weapons at us. What do you think?
I'm not sure if I would go that far, Jim, but I really do think that this was extremely important because we really have got to understand and learn from the Chinese what they're doing, and perhaps more importantly, educate them about what we're doing over here so that mm-hmm. they understand what's really required to become a modern industrialized country. I mean, you can't be a modern industrialized country without having a strong intellectual property system, period.
Well, but not only an intellectual property system, but one that places a value on other countries' systems and abides and is a player and a dealer in good faith among those nations. I mean, that's what we got to accomplish, isn't it, Ken?
Well, that's right. I mean, they have to respect our intellectual property laws. They have to respect the intellectual property laws of other countries, industrialized countries around the world. And I'll tell you, the one thing that strikes you, you know, when you go to these big cities, first of all, of course, they're extremely modern now. They've come a long, long way mm-hmm. since in the last 25 years. And as well as their intellectual property systems, trademarks, copyrights, patents. They have spent a lot of time and effort studying systems in other countries, trying to learn from those systems and trying to implement those systems. And the government has been very active in, surprisingly active, really, in trying to implement new laws to enforce intellectual property. Now, there's no question that they've had a lot of pressure put on them by other countries, primarily the United States, some mm-hmm. of these Super 301 actions, for example, to try to bring them into compliance, to try to stop the counterfeiting. And the counterfeiting is, of course, is something that is it's like cockroaches. I mean, you just can't
right.
stop it. But
right.
You know, they are doing as much as they possibly can. We met with, for example, the customs offices, the chiefs of the customs offices in each of the three cities that we visited, and they have a huge number of people that are out there investigating possible counterfeiting, trying to enforce the law,
Are they really trying to enforce it, Ken, you think?
My view is, and I don't want to be, you know, feel like I was misled by these people, but just from what I've seen, and I took another delegation over there 2 years ago, and so I have a sort of a baseline to compare
right.
against, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I've seen in those 2 years is there has been improvement. I mean, they're very cognizant that the whole world is watching. I mean, they know that they've got to comply, and it's in their
yeah.
best interest to comply. And they can't stop all these little guys on the street that are, you know, running around making the fake handbags and so on. But
mm-hmm.
They are doing, I think, a pretty good job trying to stay after these guys and develop and enforce their IP.
This is one of the most significant things that their government has got to do, and I stand by what I said a minute ago. I think the import of this issue is on par with the military issue. Stand by, 10 till, quick break, right back after these messages. Stay with us.
Be like thunder. I don't know why they don't explode.
Welcome back. It's 7 till. There's a little bit of the Stones bringing us back. Ken Krosin is our guest, and Kenneth, K-R-O-S-I-N is his last name if you're Googling him. And he's an attorney and a partner at Foley and Lardner, a Washington law firm. What is that website, Ken?
It's www.foley.com is the website.
All right, so check that out. And Ken, I'm still going to bug you about your book. I'm waiting for your book. I want to hear you get your book out when
I get 5 minutes to breathe, Jim, and when my feet touch the ground, then I'll do it. You know, one thing I do want to mention about China, which I thought was absolutely fascinating, and we met with judges over there, administrators from the different branches of IP, government, patent office, trademark mm-hmm. office, copyright office. One statistic that just kind of boggled my mind is that they are expecting this year to have over 700,000 patent applications filed in China. The number mm-hmm. in the U.S. is probably half of that. I'm not sure what the number is.
I wonder how many of those patents, though, are to establish a Chinese patent on something that's already patented in the United States that they know about.
Well, what I didn't find out is what percentage of those patents are being filed by foreigners. In other words, U.S. Companies that are filing applications in China, or European companies filing applications in China, but which would be a very interesting statistic too. But just the fact that there are so many patent applications being filed over there, and Shenzhen, the third city that I visited with our delegation, is a very interesting situation. That was declared by Deng Xiaoping after Mao died to be the first free economic zone in China, and he was the guy that really started the Chinese economic reforms. And it was just a little farming village. It's right across from Hong Kong, and he decreed that that was going to be the first free economic zone. It now has close to 8 million people. It's
wow.
Got all it's unbelievable. It's got all of these huge Chinese companies that are heavy into electronics, a tremendous amount of research and development. We were given tours of several that we visited a number of different companies, huge companies that make semiconductor chips, that make electronics, that make everything that you can imagine, really, televisions, all these things that are very, very modern electronics devices. And they are investing heavily in that technology. One of the very interesting things about that city is that it's in the Cantonese or the part of China where mm-hmm. people speak Cantonese, but mm-hmm. There are so many foreigners that have come in to live there that nobody speaks Cantonese in the city. The official language in the city really is Mandarin. If you try to speak Cantonese there, you won't be understood because it's just been invaded by people from all over the country, and they've come here to work in these technology jobs.
Ken, it seems to me that when I think of China with regard to intellectual property, I think of it as a wild, wild west. I mean, unruly, unlawful, virtually no laws. And you're telling us a little bit different, I hope that it's more like what you're seeing than what I'm thinking. But one of our Brain Trust members, Ted Fishman, wrote the book China Inc., and the last time he was on the show, I'm going to paraphrase him only just a little bit, but he said over the next generation or two, the Chinese will rewrite the rules that most of the rest of us will abide by. And he said that the Chinese do nothing apolitical. So whenever they acquire part of a company, whenever they get somebody on a board of a company, whenever their sovereign wealth funds invest in a company, there's nothing that's not political about that. There's always a political element about that. What have you found? That was a very sobering comment for him to make. And I was curious about your thoughts on that.
Well, one thing you've always got to keep in the back of your mind when you're in China is that it's a one-party government. It's a communist
right.
government, and so they really do run the show. But in the economic area, they've come to realize that the better policy is to let capitalism flourish, because the Chinese people are very, very entrepreneurial. Now, in the sense of being wild, wild west, I'm not sure I would characterize it like that. I mean, it's very organized. It's very focused. They know what they're trying to do. They know what they're trying to accomplish. And
but I'm talking about from the standpoint of being
very,
unlawful.
Very short period of time.
Yeah, I'm talking about from the standpoint of the lawfulness of it, and the control of things. Ken, we've run out of time, but this is very fascinating. I'm glad to get this report from you. I hope that what you're seeing and of course, now that you've been there twice, you've learned an awful lot. I hope that what you're seeing is going to come to pass, and I hope that people like you will continue to implore them, to encourage them to be part of the world community and to behave themselves. Ken, thanks for being here. Good job today.
Okay, thank you, Jim.
We'll see you next time. Gotta go for this hour. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate. I want to thank my heroes. That's you, small business owners. And I want to remind you to always seek excellence, not perfection.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.